ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Hello, I'm Lisa Leong on ABC Radio National's This Working Life, helping to make your work life better. In 2012, I was on a conference call as an executive leader. I used the word love in relation to our clients, and someone piped up, "Oh, Lisa, next you'll be asking us to donate goats." Why was this concept of love so uncomfortable? And what happens if you do the opposite and actually design love in? Marcus Buckingham is a global researcher. He's focused on unlocking strengths, increasing performance, and pioneering the future of work. He's a New York Times best-selling author, and his latest book is called Design Love In. Marcus, welcome back to This Working Life.
Thank you for having me, Lisa.
So you describe love as the most powerful force in business. Why is this?
If we're not careful, we think of it as a cliche, like it's my mom or it's kissing in front of the Eiffel Tower, and there's sort of nothing in between. But actually, if you look at when people use the word love and what they use it about, it's actually a driver of super productive human behavior. Love is predictive. So if you look at really, really productive outcomes at work, for yourself, it might be productivity or resilience or creativity. For your customers, it might be loyalty or repeat visits or advocacy. If you look at extreme positive outcomes, you could get them by being directive, by sort of setting goals and incentivizing yourself or your customers through pricing. And you can change behavior a wee bit that way. But if you want to have sustainable behavior change in your own life or the lives of the people you lead or serve, then you got to go back upstream. You got to follow the logic of experiences drive behaviors, drive outcomes. If you want sustainably productive outcomes, well, you got to design for yourself or for others sustainably super productive experiences. And your experiences then get internalized. They become the thing which drives your behavior. If you want really productive experiences again, then you have to behave in that way again. And so that's why experiences drive behavior. So if you then interview people who've had extremely productive experiences and you just ask them to talk, it's a customer who really, really loves that brand, or it's a particular person who's super productive on that team, or it's you because you just feel like yourself almost weirdly skipping to work this week. And you go, what happened? The word that we instinctively humans use, we don't use satisfaction or passion or joy. We use love. We say, I love working on that team. I love that leader. I love that brand. I love that company. I love that movie. I love those shoes. I love that song. Whenever we're trying to capture extreme positive human experiences, the word we instinctively use is love. And mea culpa, Lisa, I kept changing it. I'm a researcher, right?
Yeah. Well, I was going to say you are the data guy and here you are talking about love, Marcus. I mean, you know, right. I mean, I'm on the love boat, but what do you say to people who are skeptical?
Well, first of all, if people say the word love, you got to believe them. And when they say it again and again and again and again, you sort of have to unpack two things. First is the data side of it, Lisa. The relationship between experiences and outcomes is not linear. If you have a 5-point scale measuring your experiences, sorry, but moving a 2 experience to a 3 doesn't change your behavior at all. Moving a 3 to a 4 doesn't actually change your behavior at all. It's only when something happens that's so genuine or authentic or remarkable that you go 5 as a customer, as a colleague, as a leader, it's only when you go 5 that we can actually start to predict your behavior is going to change. So when it comes to experiences driving outcomes, the relationship is actually what's called curvilinear. It's like a hockey stick. Moving 2s to 3s and 3s to 4s doesn't matter. It's really for humans. The only time we're going to consistently change our behavior, like putting in that extra hour to work for that team or being extra collaborative with that person, where only time we can predict we're going to change behavior like that is when we've had an experience and we go 5. And then when you unpack 5s, the word you bump into again and again and again is love. So the answer I would say to any skeptic is, I'm sorry. The data are unequivocal. Whether you're talking about yourself, your colleagues, or your customers, love's the most powerful driver of all productive human behavior. There's nothing even close. Love is the most powerful force in business, in our own lives or the lives of the people we lead or serve. Nothing's close. So if you as the chief financial officer, let's say, poo-poo it, then that doesn't mean it's wrong. It means you're ignorant of it. Which is okay. You can go through life ignorant of the most powerful driver of productive human behavior. But I'm sorry, love is the antecedent that drives anything good that we humans do. And you can dismiss it, but that doesn't mean it's not real.
Okay. So we've got this concept of love, but you're also repeating a phrase involving experience or experience design. So why is it more for a leader to create and to intentionally design experience over just moments?
Leaders are experience makers. The question isn't whether they are one or not. The question is, are they a skilled one? And so you think about it for you as a leader, if you are a leader, that email you sent, it's not an email, it's an experience. That phone call you just had, it's not a phone call, it's an experience. That meeting you're about to have or you're about to sit in, yeah, it's not a meeting, it's an experience. And from that experience, however it's designed, and most frankly, many leaders don't design them, they just happen. But if you have a certain sort of experience at Extreme Positive, it will change your behavior.
So on LinkedIn, we asked this working lifers to nominate a 5 out of 5 experience from a leader. This is Danielle.
Megan was my first real leader in the corporate world. And what I loved about her was that she seemed to walk this very fine line that I've since realized is incredibly hard to walk as a leader myself. She had empathy, but she also had accountability. She had warmth, but she was never, ever weak. She had standards and people knew where they stood. And somehow, in all of that, she also had this effortless, no-nonsense sense of style. She was a brilliant cook and, well, it was the 90s, so we could all go out for a bit of a drink together, have fun, and then come back to work, and she could still hold that leadership line. So I think that's what made the experience 5 out of 5 for me. I felt respect from her, and because of that, we respected her deeply in return. She knew how to get the best out of me without making a song and dance about it, and she made leadership look strong, grounded, and natural. And honestly, I think she set the bar so high that she ruined me for a little for what came after.
Okay, Marcus, can you respond to Danielle's example?
Yeah, so in the book, the main thrust of the book, actually, if you reverse engineer, and I know it sounds weird, but like I loved it, the word she used, I loved, you know, what I loved about it. It's just instinctively, that's the word she used. But if you reverse engineer, love that leader. If you reverse engineer it, you don't find chaos. You find a sequence of 5 feelings that are like the feelings that move you from the start of an experience all the way to the point where you're like, I love that leader. I'll give you the 5 feelings: control, harmony, significance, warmth of others, growth. And it's a sequence. So think of them as 5 plates of armor. All of us go through life rolled up like an armadillo, kind of protected against the world, vigilant because the world is scary. And what you want is to kind of keep taking off 1 plate of armor. And if you do that in sequence, people, humans, keep leaning in. Well, the first 2 feelings are control and harmony. And what we were hearing there is a leader, control says, in any situation, I, as a team member of yours, I want to know what the rules are. I want to know what decisions I can make. I know how you're going to hold me accountable. I know whether or not if I use any of the tools, they work. I want to know whether or not I have agency in this world that you're bringing me into. That's control. Control doesn't mean control over you. Control means control over my own actions and choices. And what we were hearing there was a leader who very clearly said, this is the world I'm bringing you into. This is what you're accountable for. That's the foundation of everything. The second feeling, though, and I won't go through all of them, but the second one is harmony, because all experiences are emotional experiences. When something feels off, we find it jarring and we lean out. The armor goes back on. So any leader who can show you, I know what you're feeling and I care. I know what you're feeling and I care. I may want to move you to a different feeling, but however I want to move you, I'm going to meet you before I can move you. And from the way that we were hearing about that leader, she was clearly took the pains and also the sensitivity or the empathy to go, I want to know where you're at. I want to know what you're feeling. I might want to move you from grumpy to happy. I might want to move you from frustrated to joyous, but I have to meet you at frustrated. I might even say, hey, listen, I know this is frustrating right now, but I ... Danielle was saying that it was like a balance of accountability, but also warmth. I would see it more as an integration and a sequence. What we heard there was a leader who was very clear about the world I'm inviting you into and how that works and how you should be accountable. And I'm going to pay attention to how you're feeling, and I'm going to find different ways to show you that I care. Now, the cooking and the sense of style, I don't know that she referenced. I'm not sure that's in the book, but that's cool too.
The other thing I found interesting about what Danielle reflected on was it was her only 5 out of 5 experience. And so can you talk about unloving experiences at work?
In society at large right now, we obviously want more loving experiences. The far other end of the continuum is exploitative experiences that are immoral. We don't want those. But where do we live? Where are we allowing ourselves to live? We live in the middle. We live in a transactional world where human beings at work aren't called human beings at work. They're called full-time equivalents or headcount. Human resources systems are actually extensions of financial systems. Customers are not called people. They're called average basket size or lifetime customer value. We are reduced as humans everywhere we look. There was an email that went out to 30,000 people at Oracle last week laying them off. And the fact that they were laid off was devastating enough for them. But the manner in which that email was written treated them not as humans. They were treated as disposable elements of a headcount list. And we are sort of okay with that. And as I say in the book, you don't get more of what you expect. You get more of what you accept. And we are becoming increasingly accepting of loveless, I would call it that, loveless work environments where we think to ourselves, hey, it's okay. To your point with Danielle, she's going, that 5 out of 5 leader kind of ruined it for me for the rest of my career. And I kind of wrote the book to go, yeah, that's not okay. From a business standpoint, it's unintelligent. It's just unintelligent to design unloving experiences for your colleagues or for your customers. The data is unequivocal. Love is the most powerful driver of anything good. So it's not, doesn't make good business sense. Also, morally though, Lisa, it's like we humans don't flourish when love dies.
You're listening to This Working Life on ABC Radio National. I'm Lisa Leong. My guest is Marcus Buckingham, global researcher and best-selling author. His latest book is Design Love In. And later, Marcus has a tip you can try to help you notice when you're having a 5 out of 5 experience. So Marcus, let's talk about how to design love in. Where do you start?
Well, frankly, there's two different roles as you think about how you design love in. It's two sides of a coin. The first is mover and the second is maker. So for all of us, mover means how do I move through my own working week and find the love in what I do? The idea that you should do a job you love and never have to work a day in your life again, like that, the data on that's pretty clear. That's not real. That is not real. You can't love everything that you do. But you can find the love in what you do. And we do know that love biochemically, when you're doing an activity that you love, your brain chemistry changes and you are more open to new information, new collaboration, new connections. Your brain on love opens up. Your brain on fear or focus, frankly, although focus can sometimes be useful, narrows down. But it opens up when you're doing activities that you love. So that's mover. How do you find the love in what you do? The other side is maker. So it's mover and maker. And maker really is, okay, well, how do I make experiences for other people that they love? If it's all mover, no maker, that's narcissism. If it's all maker, no mover, well, that's a victim. You burn
doormat,
up.
Doormat, we might say.
That's a doormat. Yeah, exactly. Mm. Exactly. And that's not sustainable. So if you think about love, love is broken down into those two roles. How do I move through my own working week and find the love in what I do? And then how do I design experiences for others where you can you can get people to feel those 5 feelings: control, harmony, significance, warmth of others, growth. If you can go through life thinking, I have that power. I have the power to find the love in what I do, because no one else can do it but me, by the way. Everyone else can't see my loves, I can. I have the power to do that, and I have the power to help people feel these feelings. I'm not just letting life happen to me. I'm making these experiences happen for other people. That's a mindset shift, what I would call a mind move, I think, Lisa, because so many of us go through life feeling as though life just happens to us. And we've got to flip our minds and go, no. No, I can find the love in what I do, that's mover, and I can make experiences for other people that they love, that's maker. I can do that. Every single room that you walk into, in terms of putting your maker hat on, every listener right now is an experience maker. Every meeting you're in, you're either making it a little better or a little worse. You never leave it at zero. So for us every week to think about, well, what am I doing to give the person I'm talking to right now a feeling of control? Have I helped them know what decisions they can make? Have I helped them know what tools exist in the thing that we're talking about right now? Have I given them any tools that actually work? I need to give them control. Second, right? Have I shown them that I understand what they're feeling and that I care about it? Have I shown them, given them any signals at all, less that what I feel and more like, have I shown them that I am interested in how they're feeling and that I care about it? Not that I could change it necessarily, but that I'm aware of it and I'm sensitive to it. Those five feelings are like five sources of power. We've all got them.
And I want to look at the maker in the context of someone that you love. What do you love about Josh?
When you're a researcher like me, you do quantitative research, which is data, but you do qualitative research too, which is basically just following people around, which sounds a bit creepy, but I'd heard about the Josh effect, and this is about a year and a half ago, and he was in a senior position at Disney, and I just wanted to go and study him. The Josh effect turns out to basically mean cast members and guests loved him. And I was like, all right, well, I put my sort of skeptical British research hat on. I was like, really? Like, what's he doing? He was supposed to be ringing the New York Stock Exchange bell at 7 a.m. in the morning. It was Disneyland's 70th birthday. And there's a huge stage. There's 10,000 cast members lining Main Street at Disneyland. And 5 minutes before, they can't find him. He's vanished. And he's supposed to be right there at 7, you know, to ring the bell. And what he's done is 20 minutes before that, he ducked under the ropes and he'd gone to the gates that were holding back the thousands of guests who were about to pour in. And he was walking from gate to gate and hugging and chatting and smiling with the cast members. And just totally naturally sort of creating a, hey, I see you, how you doing? Like just really just checking in with these people who are at those gates. I asked him about it afterwards and he said, well, I wasn't trying to be, you know, I wasn't trying to make people anxious or anything. I was just doing what I normally do. And what I normally do when I go into a room these days, they normally have a stage for me to speak on because I'm at that stage in my career where they sort of ask me to stand up on stages. But I always go furthest from the stage and closest to the guest. That's what I do. It's my natural custom. I go furthest from the stage, closest to the guest, and I make sure that those cast members right close to the guest feel seen, understood. I give them a sense of I can have them be part of the same thing that I'm part of. We belong together. So it was a super intentional custom on his part. So he was a leader who's got a custom of going furthest from the stage, closer to the guest. He's taking love incredibly seriously in a way that many leaders simply have, I don't know, they've delegated it at some point or just forgotten about it. Not him. And I'm so happy Disney picked him because they could have picked a whole bunch of other senior executives who were pretty good. But this very, very, very tough board of a publicly traded company looked at all the candidates and went, hey, that person has experience, intelligence. He can design love into things. And it wasn't grandiose. It was really, really specific and intent practices or customs that he had put into his life. I'd like to believe that that's a sign that we're going to move more and more into a place where leaders like him are valued.
Yes. And so experience intelligence is an important concept. And you say that we can all cultivate this. So we don't need to be Josh-like, but we do need to cultivate our own experience intelligence. How do we do that?
Well, the first thing is, please know you have the capacity. We had Daniela talking about that leader who was 5 out of 5. You have the capacity to be 5 out of 5. You have the capacity to be the kind of leader that creates those feelings of control, harmony, significance, warmth of others, and growth. You can do that. And I don't mean everyone can be the CEO of Disney. I just mean every single one of us has the power to create those feelings in others. And when we do, people walk away going, she is so inspirational. She is so influential. Somehow she got me to do things I wouldn't be able to do otherwise. Like, and we've all got people like that in our lives where we just lean into them. It's because they've stepped into their power as an experience maker. The second thing though, I would say, that is a mind move. You got to get your head around that. You have so much power to shape the experiences of others. That's what experience intelligence is. The other thing, though, is the idea should be that you should maximize, if you can, every touch point. So if you want to make a meeting where people go, I love that, you've got to think that every single thing is a touch point. everything, the way that the room smells, the way that the lighting is done.
Well, even the invitation to the meeting.
The invitation, yes. So that's the other thing, is that an experience has a before, a during, and an after. You got to think of an experience as something that people flow through.
Yeah.
Go to your bank and you'll be handed off from one part of the bank to another. Call your airline, same thing. We live in this world of outsourced handoffs because we don't think about the before, the during, and the after of an experience. It's just a whole bunch of sort of vertical processes. We've built a world that doesn't really understand that people move through experiences, and we should go through that before, during, and after with them, at least if we want to be experience makers like Josh is. So for us, that mindset of like an experience goes through time. Let's try to break free from the handoff, vertical, siloed, transactional world we live in, and let's try to understand how to hold the person as they move through the experience.
Each week, our expert guests will nominate something for our This Working Life as something to try during the week to help make their work life better. What thing can we try this week?
Take a blank pad around with you for this week and draw a line down the middle of it. And write loved it at the top of one column, loathed it at the top of the other. Just take it around with you for a week. Whenever you see one of the signs of love, like time flies by when you're doing it, or when it feels like it's 5 minutes, but you look up, it's an hour, or you kind of pick up on details that others miss, or you just learn something quickly, or some part of it just comes so easy to you, scribble it down. It could be at any moment. It could be a moment with your kid, a moment with a friend. It could be a moment at work. Pay attention to the fives. Pay attention to those little five touch points. And then on the loathed it side, yeah, whenever you find yourself procrastinating or you find yourself trying to, you know, you feel like you've been doing it for an hour, you look up, it's only been 5 minutes. So the other side, just use the raw material of a regular week of your own life to have your life show you where the love is. And then next week, you know, I call those red threads. When an activity that you love is a red thread. Every single working week, you've got thousands of threads, like thousands of activities you got to do and things you got to follow through on. And many of them are black or green or gray or whatever. They're neutral. You just got to do them. But some of the stuff in a week is red. It's a red thread. It's something that lifts you up for no good reason other than you're you. So if you did that for a week, love it, loathe it, and you just came back, you'd look on the stuff on the right and the loved it. Are your some of your reddest threads? Well, you want to follow the rule of what the most successful people do. They don't try to have red quilt at work. Not every thread is red. But they will say, okay, well, next week, I better make sure that I pay attention to what these red threads are and see how many of them I can weave next week. Not the whole time. The data show, by the way, Lisa, it's about 20%. 20, 25% of your week could be red threads. Try to find some red threads and weave them into your life.
If I wanted to be a maker as well, though, how do I know what other people's loves are, their red threads, if it's a little bit invisible to me?
Well, the simplest thing is curiosity. So if you think about those five feelings I mentioned before, they're really five questions. So if the first feeling is control, then the question you're asking is, have I made them aware clearly of the decisions they're able to make in this world? Harmony is, do I know how they're feeling and have I shown them that I care? Which really means questions about where do you lean in? What do you find frustrating? Where did you find that easy? Why did you find that so easy? All those are harmony kinds of questions. For us, the person who really knows what their red threads are is them. So asking questions about when do they find the time speeds up? Asking questions about what did they find easy? Asking questions about where did you pick up on signals or details that others missed? If you can have an orientation like that, you'll be the sort of person that people lean into. Because they'll be taking one plate of armor off after another.
Thank you so much, Marcus.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
Marcus Buckingham is a global researcher focused on unlocking strengths, increasing performance, and pioneering the future of work. He's a New York Times bestselling author, and his latest book is called Design Love In. Thanks for listening to This Working Life. It was produced by Michelle Weeks and engineered by Tim James on the lands of the Wurundjeri people in Naarm, Melbourne. If you'd like to hear more from us, you can like, love, or subscribe to our show on ABC Listen or anywhere you get your podcasts. And you can share the love as well. Send it to a friend or a colleague you think would enjoy this working life as much as you. I'm Lisa Leong, and until next time, love your work.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.